The title today is Corinth and Coney Island, North Through the Bubble of Evil. We'll be looking at the text, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the first 11 verses. Some Bible scholars and theologians don't like 1 Corinthians that much because it doesn't lay out Paul's theology in a very easy to chart way. Often you'd go to Romans or perhaps Galatians to see Paul spelling out his theology. Paul hadn't been to Rome before and didn't know these people, and so he wanted to explain who he was and what he believed, so he would put it down that way. The Corinthians were a little different. He knew the Corinthians very well. He had written to them before. 1 Corinthians is not the first letter that Paul wrote to the Corinthians. He had been there with them. What happens in his letters to Corinth now is sort of applied theology. They're coming back with all kinds of questions to him, and so he's trying to respond. And a lot of times what he'll say, well, you know what I told you about this, and this is why, you know, you're doing this all wrong. You should be doing it this way. And so it's a little... I like it. I like it that way better because these are real people with real problems, and Paul's struggling here as a pastor to make sense of this. And sometimes I think he does a good job, and sometimes I think he messes up a little bit. If we could look at that chapter 15, this is a section that begins the question of resurrection. Apparently there were a number of questions that people in Corinth had about resurrection. Now the first 11 chapters that we're going to look at is a section where Paul does, in a sense, describe what it is that he believes and what it is he believes they should believe. He reminds them of the gospel, of the news that he had brought them previously. After these first 11 verses, then he gets into the questions that have been asked at him. Beginning at verse 11 there are apparently... some people who are arguing about the resurrection and that the resurrection really doesn't come for the dead, but it's something that happens to the living and it will be coming soon. And Paul tries to set them straight in regard to that. Then at verses 31 through 57, there are questions about, well, what is this resurrected body going to be like? I mean, you talk about this new body. What's it going to be like? And the Corinthians, apparently, some of the Corinthians had an opinion about what that body would be like. And then Paul, in his letter, says, well, someone has asked this, and that someone is a fool. And I was just thinking about who in that congregation had asked that question, and then there's this letter that comes back where he's called a fool by Paul. But today is the section we'll be looking at is a confession. He wants to remind them what the confession of the church is. This letter of what we call 1 Corinthians, we can pin down to when it was written. It was written in either A.D. 54 or 55, in the springtime. Probably A.D. 54, in the springtime. So it's very early. And there'll be a section in this that we're looking at that predates. Paul is bringing in an earlier confession. Well, 54 is pretty early. Paul's writings are the earliest writings that we have in the New Testament. So when he brings this confession from an earlier time, we're talking from the beginning. Obviously spoken by the lips of people who had perhaps walked with Jesus. So let's read through this quick, beginning at verse 1, chapter 15. Now I want to remind you, my brothers and sisters, of the good news that I preached to you, which you received and on which your faith stands. And he says remind because he's been there. He was there for probably a year and a half amongst them. Probably the core of the fellowship are the same people that were there when he was there. So he says, all right, you had all these questions for me. Let me remind you about what we had talked about when I was there. This is the gospel, the message that I preach to you. You are saved by the gospel if you hold firmly to it, unless it was for nothing that you believed. I passed on to you what I received, which is of the greatest importance. Okay, right there, midway through verse 3, is where now he inserts a confession. It would be as though I was writing a letter to a congregation and I put in the Apostles' Creed to remind them what it is that we believe in. It comes from a previous time. that Christ died for our sins, as written in the Scriptures, that he was buried, and that he raised to life 3 days later, as written in the Scriptures, that he appeared to Peter, and then to all the 12 apostles. It almost has a certain ring to it. The way it's written and said is in a different form than Paul would have written if he would have wrote it himself. It's kind of a verbal creedal form to it that could be spoken by people. Then comes a section that I'm not sure whether Paul was summarizing himself and added on to this, or whether this was another part of the creed that was perhaps added a little bit later and included on to it. But it continues, but the form of the Greek is a little bit different here in these next verses. Then Christ appeared to more than 500 of his followers at once, most of whom are still alive, although some have died. Now Paul is already getting, I think, to that question about what about Christians who obviously have strong faith, but have died, and the second coming hasn't come. And what's the story here? Well, here, even in back into the creed, he's saying that there are some followers of Christ, those within the faith, most of whom are alive, but some have died. And then Christ appeared to James, and afterward to all the apostles. Then comes a section that's obviously Paul writing here. This is Paul's addition then onto this creed, the extension of this creed. Last of all, Christ appeared also to me. Now he gets very humble here. Even though I am like someone whose birth was abnormal, or maybe a better translation would be whose birth, the time just was not right. I do not even deserve to be called an apostle because I persecuted God's church. But by God's grace, I am what I am. And the grace that God gave me was not without effect. And then, of course, here comes Paul, kind of the boaster again. On the contrary, I worked harder than all the other apostles, although it was not really my own. Of course, I think he catches himself after he wrote that sentence. Well, no, wait a minute. And then so he has to say again, it was not really my own doing, but God's grace working through me. So then whether it came from me or from them, this is what we all preach, and this is what you believe. And then he gets into answering the questions that they had about resurrection. I thought there's a number of ways we could deal with this. One way would be to look at the understandings of resurrection that the very early church had, and how that understanding of resurrection had to be retold and redefined as it was spread out and taught to other people, some of whom had no previous tradition of resurrection, perhaps, others who did, but this maybe is a new understanding of what resurrection is. So you had to redefine it again. That would be one way to look at the text. What I'd like to do, though, instead, is look at who these Corinthians were. I mean, Paul, what really is exciting about Paul and unique about Paul was his driving desire to spread the gospel beyond Palestine. I mean, he was the one that went out into new worlds, kind of like Star Trek, into new alien territories to spread the good news. And Corinth was an alien, different territory than Jerusalem. So I thought what we could do is look a little bit at Corinth and who these Corinthians were, because I think it speaks a lot to us as Christians attempting to spread the gospel out into a very mixed bag of beliefs and traditions and people. So this is, I think, a critical text for us. To do that, we should understand Corinth a little bit. Now, it doesn't matter if you can't see the details here. It's the big picture. This is, how many have been to Greece? Have there been many? One in the balcony and a couple down here. This is an incredibly accurate map, by the way. I think I figured it out to 46 statute miles per half inch. Actually, I drew the Peloponnese a little too big, I think. This is Greece right here. Greece is in a way divided in half between the Gulf of Corinth and the Saronic Gulf here. But the Peloponnese is not an island. There is a land bridge, an isthmus, that connects the two, which is kind of a solid stone mountain. And if you wanted to travel between here and there, you had to really go over that isthmus. And there were some important city-states and communities in the past. I had Olympia and Sparta down here, and of course Delphi and Athens up here. Any interchange of ideas and people and trade or whatever would come north-south right through this little isthmus. And right at the narrowest spot, it's only 3.5 miles across, was the city of Corinth. The ancient city of Corinth, and there is the modern city of Corinth. Apparently the sea level is going down a little bit. So the new town is kind of down near the water's edge, which is nice because then they didn't build over the old city the way sometimes happened. I mean, they did, but it's not as quite as ruined as it was at one point. But the old city is up here, still right on that isthmus, and you can stand on the top there where it was, and you can look out this way under the Gulf of Corinth and look out the other way. If you were a wealthy merchant, you could watch your ships coming in one way and ships going out the other way. You could sit up there at the top. All right, so you had all the major land flow coming back and forth this way, had to go through Corinth. But more important was the fact that down here, this is where Aphrodite was born. This is filled with islands down here. The lotus eaters are here. Dangerous spot to bring your boat through. I mean, storms could come up and it was difficult to chart the area. Very unsafe if you were bringing goods and you wanted to get it over to what we call Italy. It was dangerous to come around this way. Here's Crete. We're actually almost halfway at Crete to northern Africa. Italy over here, Adriatic, the Aegean, of course, Turkey would be here, the Isle of Rhodes would be here, the Isle of Patmos somewhere here, a lot of islands. Early times when you would move things by sea, you'd kind of hug the shore. That was the safest way to kind of keep in sight the land. So they'd often come up along the shoreline, maybe take a shortcut, take a risk coming across, but they'd hug the shore. Well, the cheapest and probably safest way, rather than try to get around here, where you'd be out almost in the open Mediterranean, and it would be dangerous, would be to come up into these gulfs, maybe stop at Athens and drop some stuff off, but if you were heading across, you'd come to Corinth. And you'd unload your ship at Corinth, and they'd bring it across and put it on ships on that side and go that way. The ships that were coming that way would come the opposite way and come to Corinth. All flow went to Corinth. There's some stories about smaller boats. They'd come to Corinth and they have logs, and they'd put logs down. They actually drag these boats for the 3.5 miles across and put them in the water on the other side. You know, most of the time they would unload the ships, bring it across. But it wasn't only goods that was moving. You know, all the philosophies and religions and understandings of life that were what we would call in the East, I mean, Persia and beyond. I mean, there was beginning caravan traffic into almost to India. All that thought and understanding was coming up and through here. Coming up this way, of course, from the colonies and cities in northern Africa and Egypt and Ethiopia would come up here, have to come through here. All the barbarians in Europe and whatever, and the trade and all that kind of different understandings of forest gods and all that stuff would be moving with the crews of these ships, and they'd all go through Corinth. Fascinating place, and that's where Paul went to preach the gospel.
I think it's important enough to add a little more detail about this setting and the milieu of the city of Corinth. As I said, it was a strategic setting, this bridge isthmus. Strategic in the sense that it had height and it had spring water. What is important about that is very early you need to be able to protect where you live. And so if you have height in earlier cultures, you could protect the city. Spring water, you had to have fresh water or you couldn't defend the area. So from a very beginning time, in the Neolithic times, there was a settlement there at least before the year 3000 BC. And from generation after that, there was a city of, not called Corinth then, but a city of Corinth. As I said, north-south travel and trade, east-west travel and trade, all the philosophies and religions between the Eastern world and Asia Minor and Persia and beyond, and the Western world of Italy and Spain and France moved through Corinth. Ancient Corinth became wealthy and magnificent. It was one of the most powerful and prosperous cities of the whole Mediterranean world. It survived the Peloponnesian War in 431 to 404 BC. It survived what was called the Corinthian War in 395 through 387 BC. But then it made a fatal mistake, and it tangled with the evolving political and economic and military might of what we call the Roman Empire. It became the leader of what was called the Achaean League. A number of these city-states joined together to stop Rome. A mistake. In the year 146 BC, under the Roman consul Mummius, Roman troops finally captured the city of Corinth. And then, in traditional Roman style, it was a time for revenge when the city was finally captured. And what they did is they used POWs. They took all the males from Corinth, and they forced the males to totally dismantle the city of Corinth, this ancient, magnificent city, to take it apart stone by stone, except for a few of the temples. They allowed some of the temples to remain and just renamed the gods to Roman, to Latin gods instead of the Greek. But 99% of the city was leveled. What would burn, they'd put in piles and burn. Then they cut down all the olive trees and burned everything. They sowed salt in the fields that were around. They wanted nothing there. When that was done, they took all these prisoners of war and systematically executed every one of them, except the women and children, which then became slaves. And then as the army marched beyond, they took the women and children that had been Corinthians with them. So, nothing. They had a Roman garrison there for over a century because it was a strategic spot. They couldn't just not allow anyone there. They still needed to get their goods across, but just Roman soldiers and I assume their family were there. Glorious Corinth was gone. It was just dust and ashes, a sterile wasteland except for that garrison of troops. But the real estate value was too high. It was too strategic. So a decree was issued by Julius Caesar shortly before his death, to re-establish a city. This was in 44 BC. Julius Caesar said, we cannot allow this land to just sit there, this place for a city to just sit there. So they designed a model city. It was to be the city of the future. It was to be a pluralistic metropolis open to all trade and ideas of the known world. And in honor of ancient Corinth, they named it Corinth. The first colonists that were allowed to move in were free citizens of Italy. They had apparently been slaves at one point and were freed, and so they were given this new city to move into. But probably within 5 minutes, people were coming down who were from other parts of Greece. Arabs and Palestinians and persons from that area quickly moved in. What's significant about that is there were some Jewish people, Jews that came in and settled in Corinth very quickly after it was allowed to become a city again. Soon people moved in from all over the place, from all over the known world. Prosperity returned quickly. It soon again became the wealthiest and most important city in Greece. It became the capital of the Roman province. Again, it became a meeting place of East and West. It was very pluralistic, heterogeneous. It became, in a sense, the Big Apple. This was the crossroads of the world again. But it also had kind of an Atlanta and Dallas newness and shine to it because everything was just built again. But there was money and power here. This was the best and the worst of the world at that time. It was the future touching the present. It was a wide open port city. It had a reputation of being the sin city of the old world. In fact, there's stories of sailors. And they'd say to each other, where are you going? I'm going to Corinth. And they go, oh my gosh, you're going to Corinth. This is where the action was. And it quickly built up to a population of 600,000 people, which may not sound large to us, but that is pretty big at that time. It had and this is almost true, it had a tavern and a temple on every corner. There were separate temples for Athena, Apollo, Poseidon, Hermes, Artemis, Zeus, Dionysus, Hercules, Demeter, Egyptian god Isis. This was where the famous temple of Aphrodite was. There's a big rock mountain, the Acra Corinth that overlooks the city. And when you come there, let's say we're just visiting, one of the things you did, like going up the Empire State Building, you'd always walk up the Acra Corinth. And as you went by, there would be temples all along the way, including, as Paul said, there's a temple here that says, to the unknown God. I mean, what? I mean, they ran out of names. I mean, they keep going. And at the top then was the famous temple of Aphrodite. According to the historical, the historian, Roman historian Strabo, there were 1,000 temple prostitutes up in this temple. Now, if you ever walk up there and look, there's no way you'd get 1,000 people up there. But the cult of Aphrodite, I'm sure, permeated the city itself. It was known. There was another person who wrote, said this was the fornication capital of the world, Corinth. Nero tried to cut a canal. Nero felt he could do anything. He said, you know, he's getting tired of bringing this goods and stuff across, so he was going to build a canal through the rocks in AD 66 or 67. It didn't work. It was too hard to do that. There was an earthquake every once in a while. When the earthquakes would occur and some things would fall down, the Roman emperors would always put a lot of money into Corinth, so there was always this urban renewal projects going on. Vespasian, Hadrian built there. They built things to themselves. It was, Athens was the educational capital of the world. I mean, they were very arrogant, educational capital of the world. But where the commerce and action and thought was, movement and new ideas, it was Corinth. Okay, so Paul visited there probably around AD 50. And he was there, you know, at a time when this was an up-and-coming city. It was a city of action and excitement. I don't know, how many of you that were at Greece, have you been to Corinth?
Yeah.
Have you? It's kind of a neat, the ancient cities there. When they have such things as, they had a double agora or agora. They had these broad shopping avenues with steps, and they built the steps purposely so people wouldn't, they're like speed bumps, so people wouldn't ride their chariots through there too fast and knock over people. So it was like an early pedestrian mall, and not just one agora like a lot of places, but they had like a double. This was like a super shopping mall. They had a indoor shopping center, a kind of a stoa with colonnades and little buildings. I mean, this is like going to the mall. There was a natural spring that came up right in the midst of these shops, you know, like you go to a mall today and they'll have fountains and things in the middle, very similar to that. They had some interesting sanctuaries and temples there. One was for a god of healing. And let's say you had an earache or something, well, you'd bring a terracotta ear and you'd offer it to this god. Or if you had a hand problem, arthritis or something, you'd bring a model of your hand or a little metal stamped out foot or a heart or some internal organ or something. And so today when they excavate this, there's these like piles of feet and ears and kind of things like that. And nearby, not right in Corinth, but a little further out, but the same influence of Corinth, there was a place where if you're having trouble having a child, you would come here to have a child. And there was their testimonials. People would give a testimonial to the god, and they have these kind of plaques that were carved in telling about people being healed by this god. And there was a woman who said she had been pregnant for 3 years and couldn't have this child, and finally came to Corinth and had the child. When we were there, Shirley was like, I don't know, 6 months pregnant. And I said, let's get out of here. I mean, they also found, which is significant for us, they actually found a room very right off the where the stores were that had been a synagogue. And they actually found some carvings in that indicated that this definitely was a building for the worship and understanding of Yahweh. If you remember in Acts 18, when Paul first came to Corinth, before he went with Justice, I think, over to Justice's house, he preached, it said, in the synagogue in Corinth. Well, that couldn't, now there may have been more than one, but you know, there's that feeling when you're there and visiting, this is the place. This is the place where probably Paul came to speak first. There is also at the kind of overlooking the Acra Corinth, there is a place called the Bema. The Bema was kind of the town square, and that's where they would have trials at the Bema. But also, it was a speaker's corner. And if you wanted to tell people what you felt was important. There was a little thing you'd stand up on and you'd preach to the crowds. Again, in our scripture, it tells that Paul was brought to the Bema. Well, the Bema's still there. I mean, the marble, it had been marble covered. The marble's gone. But the framework, which you could tell is Roman because it's brick, is still there. I mean, that's really the place. So you can stand there on the Bema where Paul stood. And it's kind of a, if you get a chance to go to Greece, don't miss Corinth. It's kind of a neat place to be. Well, Paul came to Corinth and stayed there perhaps a year and a half. He started a flourishing congregation. And this congregation was really made up of a motley group of people. I mean, they really represented Corinth. They were, for the most part, lower class people, not necessarily all from the same place. They weren't all from Minnesota or something. They were from all over the eastern, western Mediterranean world. And they brought with them all kinds of, spooks and beliefs and traditions and cultural baggage. The Lutheran Church today really wants to work hard, faithfully, on an inclusive church. Well, Paul had it, I mean, from the very beginning, about as inclusive as you could get. Also, according to 1 Corinthians in the first chapter there were not only poor people, but there were also apparently some very wealthy people. So economically, they were both represented in this congregation. According to Corinthians, there were someone who, we're not sure, perhaps a treasurer or some authority of the city that was a member of this house congregation. There appears to be at least one and perhaps more who had servants, which would indicate upper class wealthy people. And the other thing that really gives it away, you might remember the section where he talks about Holy Communion. And his complaint was, how can you share the body and presence of Christ when some people come early, eat all the food? Now remember at that time they'd have a meal together, a full meal. Come, eat all the food, have a good time, and then leave. And then when what would have been the poor, the slaves, the servants who got off at nighttime, finally got there, you guys are gone, all the food's gone. I mean, what kind of fellowship in Christ is that? But just the fact that there were some people that had the leisure of time to come early and eat the food indicates that they were wealthy and poor, and some problems about that, but they were together in that congregation. The Corinthian congregation would have met in one another's home for worship and fellowship. It was a mixed, worldly bunch that were unified only by their sense of Christ. That was at the center of things. That's what brought them together. That's why in our text, Paul comes back to that confession and says, let's look again at the gospel. It was in that diversity that gave them life, but also it was Christ that gave them center. They didn't come together because their parents all happened to be Presbyterians, or even that it was the thing to do in Corinth at that time, because they were certainly a minority at that time. But it was the Christ that brought them together. But these are the Corinthians. These are the Corinthians. Do you have any comments or questions about the people that the message was being brought to? I had more time, we could look at some of the questions that were brought up by these people, because they're very interesting. For example, Paul said at one point, you should not deal with fornicators. And the Corinthians, in a sense, are replying, now wait a minute, this is Corinth. I mean, how can we live with our neighbors? Remembering, of course, that the interpretation there of these temple prostitutes was tied into kind of neo-expressions of fertility cults and things tied in with religion. It's kind of a different situation. But the Corinthians are saying, wait a minute, Paul, this is the way contemporary society is for us. How can we, you've got to explain this better than you're doing. Paul says that you should kick out one that's involved with incest. And the Corinthians say, wait a minute, this guy is a part of our fellowship. He's one of the fellowship. Can't we deal with this in a more Christian way? Paul says, don't eat meat that's been sacrificed to other gods. It can be a misleading symbol. The Corinthians are saying, hey, it's no big deal. I mean, there are no other gods but God, and meat is cheap that's been offered to all these other temples. It's available. Why can't we do this? Paul said it was his opinion that women should cover their heads and let the men lead the worship. And the Corinthians are saying, hey, wait a minute. From our mixed background, we don't have never gone by Jewish rules before. Our customs are different. Why do we got to follow this kind of stuff? Paul said, keep the ecstatic spiritualism to a minimum. I mean, if you want to speak in tongues, okay, but also, you know, we're here talking to a lot of different people. You got to be rational, too. Corinthians say, wait a minute, Paul, you're the one that came telling us that we're transformed by the Spirit. Now we feel transformed by the Spirit, and you're balanced out. So there's this interchange going on in Corinthians that I think is really fascinating. But I think the gift of Corinth and the Corinthians is that vision of an inclusive church that has tied together by the Christ. And despite all those little disagreements and arguments, we are given in the end the impression that it works and that it is God, God-willed, intended. In the spirit of Haggadah, what I tried to do here is have a story that speaks a bit to the concept of resurrection that Paul wanted the Corinthians to know, but it also talks a little bit about coming together with Corinthians as Christians, coming together with those people that are around us that might be a little different than we are in many different ways. The title of this is North and Through the Bubble of Evil. An odd early June heat greeted the rising sun and a gentle rain. An offshore breeze negated any relief from the still cool sea. Sydney was playing the piano when I arrived at his home. We had some work to do, some strategizing, some serious program planning for the fall. But it was a hot June beginning, reaching towards a midday. The fall would come soon enough. So Sydney threw three or four nectarines in a clear plastic bag, and we were on our way. The rain had just stopped, but it was still hot and muggy in only June. We poured water into the radiator of his old blue Toyota Cressida. It seemed to be able to hold this fluid under pressure for only about 2 hours. And even with the radiator filled with water, the engine on occasion or on a whim would overheat. Sydney's attempted remedy, not necessitating the expenditure of any money, was to drive with the heater on full blast. Sydney's rationale was that with the heater on at full capacity, heat would be transferred from the engine block to the interior of the car, keeping the motor just cool enough to function for an hour or so, even though it didn't do much for the functioning of the passengers, especially on days like this day of steam heat. Sydney's explanation had the ring of nonsense, but one does not take chances with automobile engines about which Sydney and I knew absolutely nothing. They are instruments of mystery and frustration, harboring vindictive traits. We took the Garden State Parkway to the turnpike at the Woodbridge exit right after the humpback twin Perth Amboy bridges, and then in those days took the Outer Bridge crossing. We were, of course, in the realm of the demonic, through North Jersey and into New York. One's vision was pulled towards the massive Staten Island landfill with its huge resident flock of garbage-dumped seagulls. They hovered in the sky over the remnant waste of our desire to acquire plastic and paper and metal fragments of our greed buried into the now poisoned earth by smoke-belching bulldozers. And through our car windows entered now, and the whole atmosphere seemed to hold the damp heat smell of rot. We approached the Verrazano Narrows Bridge in silence. Like a giant cross on the skyline, off to our right in the distance haze, we could see our destination. The steel framework of the parachute drop marked the location of Coney Island. Now you realize that this is all alien territory. The denizens of North Jersey and New York come down to our shore to spend their money in the summer sun, and we put up with them for a couple months, just barely. You see, they are loud, they drive too fast, they wear black bathing suits, and they're on vacation. They are consumers of the sea. Their rudeness lingers. And in addition to their general all-around obnoxious behavior, they talk funny. They assassinate words in their rush of supposed living. Perhaps this is the most grating of all, their rush of living. And something's wrong in the sense of out of order, unnatural, with those Staten Island seagulls just hanging around, circling over those mountains of garbage, fighting over even scraps of plastic that'll eventually kill them. a cloud of gulls with no apparent thought of beach walking or mist gliding or clam eating. They are to be scavengers of gifts, not waste. Something's very wrong with this part of the world, all out of step with the universal intention of nature in the pure process of renewal. And now Sydney and I were driving north into this alien land of perceived distortion. We hold our staff planning meetings each Friday morning, but it was such a hot day that is only part of the reason, though, why after a very little debate we decided on Coney Island. In the grace of freedom, sometimes we stretch to poke our heads through the bubble wall of evil just to look around, not to stay, we say. Sure, we had the homegrown certainty of Seaside Heights and Wildwood, but what sucked us into the whirlpool of northern corruption was the pitiful fact that Sydney was a roller coaster freak. He had been for most of his life patterned in youth by a careless father who loved dusty county fairs around their eastern Pennsylvania home. And now Sydney's craving was a serious addiction. He had flown some of the great coasters of North America, but had never yet ridden the near-mythic cyclone of Coney Island. Actually, he had purposely put off the moment, wanting to live for a while in the realm of anticipation. He feared living his life in the backside slide down the other side of this peak experience. But his desire had become so intense that it necessitated now this Friday morning sortie into New York territory, into that blur of elevated trains and yellow cabs, and the earth so transformed by cement that one questions one's own origin. But it was precisely here that the cyclone lives. I can understand from a distance the inner, visceral, and mental demands of this serious addiction that was eating away at Sydney's soul, and agreed out of pure friendship that our weekly Friday meeting this week should be held north and with a different agenda. You see, friendship often drags along accomplices. The cyclone is an original piece of psychic craft and art. It embodies the spiritual force within the soul of all old wooden roller coasters. The cyclone's initial plunge, that first cliff drop of the small open train of cars, was at one time in the past judged the best. The best in the sense of simulating the nearness of tragic death before being jerked back to another mountain cliff and another fall, always pulling you back but with no guarantees. It was a pilgrimage for Sydney. Crossing the Hudson was crossing the Jordan for him. I was along for the ride and friendship and a promise of the sea, even this alien northern expression of the same sea that washes the Jersey shore. I'd never been to Coney Island, what with Seaside and Wildwood and my fear of plummeting from high places while strapped into a little open container. I do remember singing Coney Island Baby in college, a fraternity sorority sing in the 1960s, and blocking out images of Vietnam jungles with mental images of boardwalks and surf and wonderment over the elusive possibilities of true love. We exited off the Belt Parkway and took West 17th Street straight towards Surf Avenue and the boardwalk. Tucked between Gravesend Bay and Coney Island, we should have transversed a salt marsh, but there was no muskrats and no sweet sea and eelgrass smells, no undulating dunes growing cottages with white pebble lawns. Rather, the pathway was graffiti-marked cement and abandoned storefronts, burned-out cars, blowing newspapers of yesterday's news in other places, crushed beer cans and rolling wine bottles, and an incredible amount of shattered glass, like shards of mirrors reflecting light of a sun struggling through the haze. Even as one closed in on the sea, derelicts slept in doorways, and hairless, nervous dogs nosed through gutter litter. And this was now the heart of the amusement area. It was a hot June day by the sea, and it seemed as though the cycle of life was about to surrender. What have we done to the earth? What have we done to each other? We parked a half a block from the boardwalk in a dirt lot marked by the sign $2 all day parking, but no one was around to collect our money. And it was the afternoon, and June, and I'm fully aware that old boardwalks need some time to wake up from the night before, but this had the glazed-eyed look of a coma. The boardwalk heading south was wide but worn. Nail heads rose a quarter inch above the wood in a snaking line running down the center. Spiked splinters laid in wait. bike tires and bare feet, and I wondered what else could hold no hope in this walkway. Signs of past glory still littered the scene. There were large wooden columns painted to look like marble, though they now had an obvious pine grain heart. Through the plywood cracks of a boarded window, one could see stained glass. Peeling roof trim on a gutted bathhouse was carved into rhythmic pattern of ocean waves. It was noon now, and this section of the boardwalk was still completely deserted. We walked past the giant, towering iron and steel structure of the parachute ride, which had been moved here soon after a 1930s World Fair. It stood now a remnant, rusted and askew like the struts of an old windblown umbrella. Cables blew in the wind. Even the graffiti around its lower extremities were seasons old. Near its base was the cracked cement interwoven roadways of a kiddie turnpike ride, winding, weaving through 4-foot weeds. It looked like something after the bomb. Is this where old amusement rides go after they fail to amuse, or where people are incapable of being amused? Behind a fence were the carcasses of old wild mouse cars, their painted rodent faces and wide eyes streaked now with a veneer of soot and tears of splashed mud. These small cars and their metal tracks were once used to hook children into the world of roller coasters and the thrill of near death. Now a snarling German shepherd whose eyes remembered caribou kills within a pack of other wild brothers and sisters on Pleistocene tundra bared its teeth at us through a gap in a high wooden fence that was spray-painted with the words "White Power." Had a cup of tea, it's gone. As we walked north, ahead of us stood another fence and more weeds, but behind them and soaring above them stood the smooth, clean lines of a fabulous, old, genuine roller coaster. Sidney enlivened. His walk was now a gait. But as we approached the glorious wooden serpent, joyous expectation shifted into disappointment. The wooden support beams were streaked gray and split with age and darkened with moisture where they reached down to touch the sandy earth. Perhaps that was their mistake, reaching down to touch this human earth of decay. And the rails were rusted, weeds dominating the lower runs. Its car sat right before us, the rounded, low, red image of speed, but now in a tight row, frozen, silent, impotent, the stuffing pushing out through the cracks in their red leather seats. But one could still look up, the coaster's intertwining trestles against the clearing sky had that certain free flow that defines time and limitations of decay. It was the thunderbolt, the cyclone's once worthy but now apparently defeated competition. There were tears in Sydney's eyes. We were on Bowery between 15th and 16th streets. Dwarfed beneath the eastern ruins of the Thunderbolt was a 6-story disheveled house, all that remains of the once glorious Kingston Hotel, glorious to people like Sydney, an abandoned, desecrated temple placed once on holy ground. But with eyes fixed only on the highest arches of the coaster, we walked further north. We entered a part of the amusement area that still now offered some animation, though just barely. It was afternoon now, and the food stands and rides in the Astroland Arcade in this pocket of life were just now waking up. The giant Wonder Wheel slowly, reluctantly began to turn, lifting its massive cage seats in rotation with a groan. More newspapers blew by with their front page stories of drug-related murders and nations at war. They would be captured in corners to be partially covered by gray sand that was intermingled with urban dirt. A red, vacant, oval-shaped fiberglass car crashed open a pair of swinging doors, and one could, for a moment, could glimpse into the black, lack-of-light void that was the very gate of hell. Above the exit door was painted the image of 3 or 4 people screaming in torment in a leap of painted flames. On the 25-by-40-foot exterior entrance gate to the funhouse, painted for cash by Soho artists in need of rent money so that they wouldn't have to live in Jersey City, was the smiling face of a devil and the words, "All ye who enter here, abandon all hope." We walked on, and even the sound of the churning sea could not save the sense that the human family, with perhaps the highest expectations of joy, had, with a foundation of greed, mixed with the whim of freedom, had even on the very border of earth and water, concocted a killing ground of human hope for all who enter here. I lowered my head as we walked, forgetting for a moment the sea struggling to cleanse itself, and thought that there was no need to pay a dollar to ride an open car into the devil's mouth. One can walk, even with a friend, and even so close to the sea, into its mouth, for free, abandon all hope. Finally, we reached our assumed destination, standing proudly on firm-footed, newly painted white support frames was the cyclone. The cyclone towering and winding and higher than expectations. Sydney was breathing heavily, and the coaster was waiting for customers, waiting for us. At last, things seemed right. I mean, the rest of the world may be in decay and hunger and homeless and polluted, but we got what we want. The track arched its back 8 times, and the downside of the first arch was the wicked decline of historical fame, infamous. From above and below, it appears as though it plunges cars and lives straight into the sand. And they do, as the tracks twist slightly south during the drop to give the added sensation that the cars have disengaged from the track and then enter into a hole scooped out of the sandy dirt, quickly rising again up the slippery back of the next arch for the next fall, all before one can catch a breath. This hole at the foot of the first drop was supposedly added when a competitor built a coaster slightly higher than the cyclone. Tradition claims that it was the desire to be second to none which thrust it into myth and greatness. Second to none, only first, like our desire. With the added depth, the cyclone was again number one in the sensation of death from falling, along with the illusion for the rider of actually crashing into the earth, entering a sand tomb, being swallowed in a moment of darkness before being yanked out and up again for another fall. There was no waiting line this early afternoon. Sydney and I bought a ticket from a disinterested elderly cashier in the shadows of a booth with iron bars protecting its one window. And Sydney and I just walked through the gate and up the ramp. For the full effect of a roller coaster, one should have to stand in a long line of other nervous, bragging people. This is an important psychological trapping of the great coasters that was denied us that afternoon. A queue of others, bodies close, casually eyeing each other and wondering about the other's history and future, all this necessitating at least a 15-minute wait at best, because it forces one to think about that first drop with these strangers and our human freedom of choice and the destiny of chance and the thrill and threat of a technology that claims to be able to keep speeding cars on a flimsy tracks pieced together by human hands and minds that may have been at the time they assembled the track tired or angry or in pain or lulled careless by the sound of the surf. In a line before a visible precipice, one is edged unsuspectingly into considering one's own mortality. Well, we didn't have the reflective time of a wait in line, but all the other proper psychological props were in place. Wooden signs, white with red lettering, lined the walls of the walkway to the waiting train of cars. Heart patients and pregnant women should exit immediately. Remove your eyeglasses. Remove pens and pencils from your pockets. Remove wigs. The management is not responsible for injury or death. A metal safety bar that mocked its name, actually a slippery chrome tube, was snapped too loosely across my lap. One could be sucked out of that car so fast while both hands were raised in defiance. And then after the classic head-snapping start, the cog gear engaging, that click, 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 click as the little open train of cars makes its slow ascent up the old shaking timber frame. And this was the real thing. not those new slick steel and hydraulic coasters and so-called theme parks run by big business syndicates, ruining rural pine and swampland settings with coasters that are too smooth and firm, too scientific, and promise to county commissioners to be fail-safe. They have the feel of computers pacing Swiss-made metal precision on rubber tires. They hold no wood or anything else in its natural form that has grown in the sunlight. One needs to feel the very foundation we share shudder and creak and moan and call out to us, even though you may be young, you can die. As we reach the very top, in that momentary pause before the fall that for some of us seems forever, Sydney was in ecstasy. And he yelled out to the hazy sky, "This is it. This is it." The drop was as terrible as I feared it would be. After the speed and whirl of repeated rise and fall of the ride as we stood by the exit gate, Sydney appeared to be sad. He said that it was a great roller coaster, it was a great ride, but not the ultimate thrill that he longed for. What could that be, he said, more to himself than to me. Maybe sex on a roller coaster, he said. Maybe jumping off a roller coaster. Maybe owning a roller coaster, or to be famous and ride a roller coaster. What would do it? What to hope for? What to live for? Well, Sydney stayed with the Cyclone. A purist must re-ride a coaster a multitude of times from different locations on the train, front, back, middle, for an objective evaluation. I walked a few blocks north along the boardwalk and past the bocce courts to the New York City Aquarium. Beluga whales are more my speed. And if you walk to the roof of the observation platform and have patience, the white whales with innate smiles will come up to the top of their confining tank and talk to you about their remembrance of the open sea. Later that afternoon, we walked back towards Sydney's car, back through this alien territory of Coney Island, our expectations belittled, our thoughts on decay and the rape of the environment when it began to happen. People began to arrive, spilling with laughter from elevated trains spray-painted with Hispanic poetry of force laced with integrity. It was a mixture of persons from every race and place and experience, which could have been perceived as strange and different, alien, driving Sydney and me to even deeper loneliness, super urbanized and socially, emotionally, linguistically, and culturally different than me, and yet so much the same, it seemed at that moment, all seeking more than a thrill in a June day by the shore. But what hope, if any, do they or I share? What future, what purpose? And yet they celebrated life as they walked by me. They smile and laugh and tease and anticipate the ocean breeze. An old gray man limped past, pant legs wet and feet sandy. He carried a full bucket of freshly dug low-tide surf clams to be diced for one of his favorite Italian recipes from the old country. Tonight it would be chilled Chianti from a gallon bottle and white clam sauce for his linguine to be shared with his whole family. And let's invite over the daughter's family from Queens with all the kids and get a couple of loaves of garlic bread. It was going to be a family celebration, you could just tell. And heading towards the beach was a noisy group of little interracial children, all wearing the same bright yellow t-shirt of some local daycare center. They walked by smiling and kidding and anticipating and holding hands that were ready to dig in the beach sand. And maybe, if their teachers were in a good mood, they could be allowed to get their feet a little wet after piling all their sneakers in a big mixed-up red, white, and blue pile. Just their feet a little wet would be their teacher's unreasonable wish. Hispanic teenagers glided by on the boards together to the sound of their oversized Pioneer tape player box, together with me on a clearing, welcome to summer Friday afternoon. And the humidity seemed to lift, and the ceiling of things raised, and there was breathing room. Food stands were now open for business around the Astroland arcade, and they reflected clearly the parade of people, of us, past and present, positive pride and potato knish and kosher pizza and southern barbecued ribs. Real lamb was promised in some blackened shish kebab. There was Spanish meat pies and moussaka and fresh mussel and a spicy tomato sauce that should be eaten in celebration with friends who understand you and accept you. And the all-beef hot dogs at Nathan's were, to my taste, at that awakened moment, very good. I mean, excellent. My hot dog was handed to me by a young, dark-skinned woman with Asian eyes who seemed to be a mix of all of us. Her smile was haunting, and that counter was only a temporary stage in the process of her living, and she knew that well. We were a mixed and motley group, but shared more than just the unconscious yet common desire to face death together on the cyclone and reemerge with personhood intact. We needed forgiveness. I need forgiveness. We are the same community. We plunge into the sand together in this place from where we came, Brooklyn and Jamaica and Staten Island, the old country, the Jersey Shore. Can it be a right to care, affection, respect, not to be abused or neglected, but protected by the will of others mirroring a more perfect order from forces that tear body, mind, and soul asunder? And when cities and lives that form them decay, a part of me, part of us, decays. Can there be grace in this place before the face of the devil whose mouth swings open for us under the words, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here"? As Sydney and I walk back to the parking lot before a fast-approaching thunderstorm, once again we walk through that area of most disrepair and decay. Back through the graveyard of past joy, through the weeds and rust, the area of the park that we had thought was long dead, where there was despair feared to be so thick there was no room for hope. But then we heard a rattling sound and a click, 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 and then we saw the movement of open cars on the old wooden arches that loomed ahead. Life was surging and offered even here, even now, again, the old Thunderbolt roller coaster was alive. And an old carny with a straw hat and a cigar was beckoning us towards the old red coaster cars, which were losing their stuffing but not their heart. Other people appeared, laughing and sharing joy among themselves that spilled over to us. And together we entered and we filled the car seats. And like a phoenix, we rose again above the ashes and rubble of despair and differences, transcending together both loneliness and chaos. During that slow ascent, pinned to the back of our seat as the car's nose towards the heavens, a teenage boy in the seat directly ahead turned his head with a laugh to glance down and back at Sydney and me, and we laughed back. Sisters and brothers in front and in back of me, in my history now and future, and a part of my responsibility now, finally together in intended unity. And as we reached the arched peak, there together we shared for a moment a view of an endless ocean. And above us and before us, actual lightning bolts slashed the sky of Coney Island. And there were grand claps of thunder. And we fell together, yet of course rose again, united in the time-stopping and space-connecting speed of it all. Cindy and I walked back to the cooled-down Toyota through the weeds and litter that bordered the parking lot. But it was all different now. And what can we do about hatred and disharmony and separation? We drove over the high arch of the Verrazano Narrows, heading for the parkway, and north and south and the beginning and the end was united. We were reunited. I think Paul would, walking into Coney Island, would feel at home. I know the Corinthians would feel at home there. I think we are one people. We share at the base our humanity, our ability to give and to withhold love. And the Christ came to say that life and future is in the giving of that love, in being whole and being human and being Christ-like. I think that's what Paul was struggling to say about the meaning of resurrection and forever to the Corinthians, to those in Coney Island, to me,
to forgive my prejudices, to pull us together. Just a footnote about this, Sidney Pitts was my choir director organist, and as some of you know, choir director organists are a little weird anyway. I was pastor of a church right outside of Princeton, and Westminster Choir College was in Princeton, so we'd get our choir masters and organists from Westminster, and Sidney became a good friend, and I was talking to someone here who was from Princeton, and she said she had taught at Westminster Choir College. And I said, well, I knew somebody from Westminster Choir College, Sidney. I'm going to talk about him on our trip to Coney Island. And she said, what's his name? I said, Sidney Pitts. She goes, I know Sidney Pitts. So, is she here?
Where yes, she was.
Oh, okay.
She had to leave early.
Yeah. She's leaving today. I know. Maybe she had to pack. Any comments or reflections or experiences in a Coney Island near to you? Our first session here, someone was talking about those that hang glide off of mountains in Washington State, and even in Holden, apparently there's a couple that have come up every once in a while and jump off one of these mountains and land over here in the tailings. And the stories they tell afterwards about kind of that sense of bragging and fear and sharing things together is similar to Coney Island.